when you grow up in a dictatorship and you come to the land of the free, it's quite shocking when you realize, wow, you can just say what you think in America.
Hi, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and this is Kelly Corrigan Wonders. Today, I'm thinking about what it feels like to be an African American, as in a person who grew up in Africa and as an adult became an American. Mbolo Mbue, who you might know as an Oprah favorite, is a friend from my writer life. She left Cameroon for New Jersey as an 18-year-old, and once she got here, after a stint selling lingerie and working the door at an apartment building, she wrote Behold the Dreamers, and more recently, How Beautiful We Were. We talked about what happens when a place you imagined becomes the place where you live. If you want to see this country through new eyes, join us for a conversation with Mbolo Mbue. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and I'm here with writer Mbolo Mbue, talking about immigrating to the United States, the choice, the work, the flood of emotions that comes with that transition. So, Mbolo, I wanted to start by asking you your story of America. I'm curious, what was your early childhood impressions of what America was, and, and where were you growing up?
So I was born in Cameroon. I am from a town called Limbe, which is right on the Atlantic Ocean. At this point, it's like a small city. It has nightclubs and fancy hotels and museums and a botanic garden. But when I was growing up, it wasn't quite at that level. So I am from Limbe, but I did spend my early childhood in a couple of villages. My mother worked for the government. My mother was a community development assistant. So she taught women how to live better lives, to put it easily.
Did you grow up admiring her so for that work?
Yes, because she taught women how to knit and how to sew, how to cook nutritious meals. She also taught at a school for the blind. And one of my earliest education was about the fact that it doesn't matter what you are. My mother will come home and say, look at what my blind students made to. They cannot see, and then look at what they did. So I was taught very early to not complain, that, you know, if her blind students could do all these wonderful things with their hands, that I could do something too.
Yeah.
So that was my early childhood in these villages. And then when I was about 8 years old, my mother sent me to live with my aunt. And that was when I discovered literature. Because in the villages in which we live, we didn't exactly have access to books, at least nothing besides the books I read at school. And it was in my aunt's house that I first discovered Shakespeare, Dickens. And I was very fascinated by stories. And it probably wasn't the most appropriate reading for a 9-year-old. But I love The Merchant of Venice. I love The Taming of the Shrew. I love A Tale of Two Cities. And so that was something that really opened my eyes to the bigger world. I also had a very religious upbringing. So my aunt was a religious woman. So I spent a ton of time in church. And I think that I found myself somewhere in a space between religion and literature.
That's an interesting space. I mean, talk about like rich with story, like the whole, both sides of the equation are feeding you these characters and these journeys and these resolutions. Were you so sad to leave your mom?
I was, yes, because I, I was, you know, with my mom in this village, and I obviously was easier for me. And then I moved to my aunt's house, and there was many more children. But I think that is probably what pushed me towards books. And also, like I said, the religion, because somebody said to me that my writing in my new novel is kind of biblical. And I was thinking, a lot of the stories that shaped me as a child were stories from the Bible. Noah, Adam and Eve, you know, Joshua, Moses in the Red Sea, all of those stories. And it's a certain way those stories are written. There's a certain kind of language. So this literature and religions, I think it created in me without a desire to be true to myself, to find myself, maybe in a way that I wasn't exactly taught. Mm-hmm. But there was something about discovering literature and also having religion that encouraged me to be true to myself.
Are you religious now?
I am a person of faith. I do not live by dogma. I question a lot of the things I was taught, you know, believe this, do this, don't do that. But I still live my life by spiritual principles.
Interesting. So can you tell me your first thoughts about America? Like, what version of our country were you hearing about in your village in Cameroon?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the version where everybody here is happy and successful and living in nice houses. And that version came from two sources. There was the first part where it was what we saw on television, right? When I was growing up, I think my first American show was The Cosby Show. I think that was the 80s. So that was the introduction, which for an African child just seemed like a wonderful, glorious, you know, way of life. And then later I discovered The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. We had Beverly Hills 90. And the overall idea was that America was this place where you went to have a wonderful life. And the people from my town who went to America and came back, they fostered this idea. Because when they came back from America to visit, they wore nice clothes. They had a lot of money that they spent around. So there was nothing in what I saw to suggest that America was a complex place.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the power of television. Okay, so you're hearing these stories about America, and it's all very simple and perfect. And in the novel, How Beautiful We Were, there's this character that you've developed named Tula, and she's remembering talking to her dad, and her whole world's being ruined by oil. And the dad says, well, in America, there are 7,000 people, and they're all very tall, and time moves faster, and that's why they need cars, and cars need oil.
Right. But yeah, that was the kind of simplistic notion we had of America. Mostly the people that we knew were people, missionaries, right? Were missionaries. They came to bring us good news, or people went to America to become rich. But it really was, we didn't have much to go by besides television. Of course, today the internet is right there.
So under what circumstances did you first set foot in America?
So I came here to go to college in New Jersey, Rutgers University. I was blessed to have relatives who helped me to come here to go to college.
You came by yourself and you land at JFK or something?
Newark International, yes.
And you're just little Limbolo Mbue, future Oprah Book Club pick, landing in Newark, getting ready to go to Rutgers.
Yeah, well, I traveled with a couple of relatives, but yes, I ended up going to college by myself, and I wasn't thinking far, right? I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go to college. And my dream at that point, as a 17-year-old arriving in America, was to become an accountant. something very sensible, because that's what people came to do in America. They came here to get sensible careers, accountant, doctor, pharmacist, something that, you know, will help you buy a nice house in the suburbs and give, you know, have enough money to help your family back home.
When you came here, did you assume that you would become an American?
Kelly, I really wasn't thinking that far ahead. I was just thinking, let me just go get, you know, a degree and become an accountant. That was a big dream.
And what was your major?
Well, I started accounting. I took accounting 101, and that was the end of that. I flunked the whole thing, and I couldn't understand anything. And that, so I tried to switch to finance because I discovered a thing called Wall Street, and I thought, well, I could do finance and end up on Wall Street. I had this very immigrant mentality. It was very much about like, get a job that you can pay your bills, which is makes sense, you know. So I tried finance, and again, it didn't work for me. And so I ended up doing business management, which was much simpler. I was just learning managerial skills, you know, communication, simple stuff like that. And that was where I excelled.
Did you have a very big divide mentally or emotionally between what you do to make a living and mm-hmm. what you do to thrill your soul? Or did you not even have the luxury of thinking about thrilling your soul?
I did not have that luxury. There's no such thing where I come from. I mean, it is such an American idea to me. Because when I go back home and I see my friends and I say, do you love your job? They're like, they say, what do you mean? Do I love my job? What does that even mean? You do what you have to do to pay your bills. You don't need to love your job. You don't need to enjoy it. Who cares how you feel about it? So that is how I felt. I was in a new country. I didn't have a mother, a father to take care of me. I had to do whatever I needed to do to take care of myself. So there was no thought whatsoever to my calling or my purpose or what is going to satisfy my soul. That was all very she stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I remember saying to my mom, even just to, you know, one generation difference, it's not very satisfying. She was like, satisfying. Like, do you have a paycheck every 2 weeks? Like, the satisfaction is like putting money in your bank and saving some of it for your retirement. Like, that's what you're doing. Don't get confused here about the point of this. What were some of your first impressions of America? Like when you were at Rutgers, were you like, oh, this is a lot different than people said it was?
I remember when I was driving away from Newark International Airport and we're driving through Newark, New Jersey. And we're going somewhere. And that was the first time that I saw an inner city, because we drove to some inner city neighborhood. And I never thought that America would have homelessness, dilapidated houses, people standing around on the street corner who seem to not have jobs. And that was my first couple of hours in America is what I saw, an inner city. So that was certainly shocking. But after that, I started also noticing something that I hadn't seen before, which was surprised me, which is a wonderful thing, was how much freedom there was in America. I was amazed at how free people were in this country to say things that came to their mind. I grew up in a dictatorship. My country has had the same president for almost 40 years now. So when you grew up in a dictatorship and you come to the land of the free, it's quite shocking when you realize, wow, you can just say what you think.
Right. Yeah. And you can fight back against things, which is so much about how beautiful we were. That's what it's really about in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like, how does this small village fight this multinational oil company that probably doesn't really care about destroying the lives and killing the people in this small village with their sort of sloppy practices and total disregard for some corner of the environment.
Right. Yeah. And that was certainly something about that experience of freedom. Coming to America and seeing freedom that stayed with me until I started this novel, because I had never really thought about freedom. It was one of the first things that I really got to appreciate about this country.
And the other thing that's interesting in the novel that I wonder if it's a part of what you observed in America or hoped to observe is at some point someone says, what can one angry woman do? That American educated women are basically like a pain in the ass. But nonetheless, they're small and insignificant and easily rolled. Mm-hmm. And that to me struck me as an African take on an American myth. Which is to say, like, we're like the Aaron Brockovich nation. We believe that there is this potential for a charismatic individual to change everything. Mm-hmm. And we really want to believe that. And we have a whole system of things that create the possibility for that to happen. And so we want to see stories where all those systematic inputs yield the big change.
Yeah.
But in your book, it doesn't.
Well, without giving away the ending, I would say that this is no Hollywood story, right? This is a story about how complex it is to take a stand, how difficult it is for one woman, one community, one small African village to fight against a multinational. It is a very audacious thing to do. And as the story shows the struggle and the sacrifices that everybody has to make for this struggle, and the main character, Tula, talking about me coming to America and getting educated here, she came to America and got educated here also. America is somewhat the place that opened her eyes to bigger notions of freedom and bigger notions of justice. And she has this agenda that if the Americans can do it, if they can build a country that people can come in and feel free, why can't we do the same also?
Yeah, I mean, that's everybody's fear, right? This is why people take away books in dictatorships. Because they think, like, the more you learn about the way it's done elsewhere, the more demands you're going to have. And you're just going to be, like, up in my dish all the time. And I'd rather you just stay quiet and beaten down and uneducated, because it's just much easier to rule a population like that.
That's right. And that is the one thing about Tula, is that she realizes from reading books that, oh my God, I can learn. I can figure out how to change stuff by reading books. And there's, I don't know, did you watch the TV show The Wire? There was a character there. He said, I've forgotten his name, but he said to somebody, do you know what the most dangerous thing in America is? And he said, the black man with a library card. Mm. And I always think about that, because I thought, when I came to America, I always had a library card. The moment I move to one town, I get a library card and I borrow as many books as I can, because I, like Tula, I realized what books could do for me.
Yeah.
And my writing comes from being a reader, and also growing up in a place where I didn't have a lot of access to books, and coming to America where I could walk into a public library and get any books. I didn't even think about that before coming here, that there's a place where you could walk into and you could walk out with 10 books that you just borrowed. I mean, it just fascinated me.
That's so interesting. Have you read Susan Orlean's book, The Library Book?
No.
Oh, it's so fun. It's such a celebration of the miracle that is a public library.
I walk into a public library never having thought about writing. Never in my whole life considered writing. I walk into a public library, I borrowed a book, went back home, read it, and I started writing. Like, I tell people, they say, how did you become a writer? I say, I walk into a public library. That was the whole story of how I started writing.
And it was Toni Morrison, right?
That's right. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon.
Yeah. So let's back up. You graduate from Rutgers, and what's your job?
Oh, what did I do? I did a lot. I was a teller at a bank. I worked as a receptionist at an apartment building. I sold lingerie at the department store.
I mean, it's amazing to think that later today across America, people are going to go interact with the person who runs the front desk at an apartment building. Right. And they may be interacting with a future, like, award-winning novelist, Oprah Book Club pick. Like, that's incredible to remember. That the people you're interacting with have dreams. Like, it's like Behold the Dreamers, your first novel, is so moving in that way. Like, it wakes you up to the sea of people in front of you and thinking about, like, what epic journey are you on? Like, what is your big dream that you're trying to realize?
Yeah, and I think that is very American. Dreams and reinvention is very American.
Yeah. So how long have you been in – how long has it been since you started college here?
Oh, I came here. Oh, I've been here for 22 years now, most of my life.
Yeah. What do you wish was different?
That's a toughie.
I know.
You know, I struggled a lot being poor in America. American poverty is ruthless.
Worse than African poverty.
Way so, from my experience. I mean, let me talk about my town. What did being poor mean? Most people, they had a house, they had food. They had family and friends around them. They had shelter. They had the basics. They were happy. Life was full. I mean, when people make fun of Africans who live in huts, I just want to laugh, because I knew people who live in huts and they were not poor. They had full, wonderful lives. So there wasn't a sense of poverty in my town growing up. I tell people I wasn't poor till I came to America. And then I said, oh, this is poverty. Because it just drains you. It almost takes away your humanity. How hard you have to work, how much you're thinking about the next step, what to eat, how to pay your bills. It's such a struggle. And yes, I left Cameroon at 17. I didn't have to do that. But even my mother, who was not wealthy, she could afford a basic life, comfortable life for us. And all around me, like I said, even my neighbors who did not have a lot of money, people were happy. They had time to themselves. There was a certain ownership of your life. American poverty takes away the ownership of your life. A lot of Behold the Dreamers came from trying to reconcile how wonderful this country is and the brutality of the poverty here.
Yeah. What would you change to change that?
You know, this country is what it is. I don't know how to change it. I think, you know, it's capitalism. this is what capitalism gets you. Capitalism is also what got me a book deal. I mean, my publisher is a corporation, so I benefit from that. I don't have answers as a novelist. I am one of those people who I use my writing to ask questions, and I really wish I had more answers, but I don't.
Yeah. Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I want to thank everybody who's talking to me on Instagram at Kelly Corrigan. Let's pick up in our conversation with writer and thinker and friend Mbolo Mbue. Tell me about becoming a citizen. What was that like?
Well, it was, I should say that for a while I was conflicted about becoming a citizen because it meant giving up my Cameroonian citizenship. Cameroon does not allow dual citizenship. And I just did not like the idea that for me to go back to my home country, I needed to get a visa. And I really didn't want to, but I also knew that this is my country now also. Cameroon is my country, but this is my country also. And it took me a while to get there, but when I finally did apply for citizenship, process was wonderful as far as how much it seemed like they were eager for me to become a citizen. I remember when I went for the interview, the lady was just very lovely and very kind. And when I, on the day of my citizenship oath ceremony, I cried my eyes out.
You did?
Yes, because it was to be an American, Kelly, to be an American, it's a special thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you feel about being an American, but to me, having come from a country where I did not have the kind of opportunities that America affords me, I recognize what a privilege it is. Even as much as a Black person, I know that this country is very flawed. I still recognize the opportunities that I have been given, and I am very grateful for it.
Yeah. So, you know, right now is this time where all this division is being laid bare. I mean, I would say that it's been there for a long time, honestly. But how do you think about this moment that we're in right now?
Well, so when I came here in 98, it was a very different country. I felt very welcome. I thought Americans were the most accepting and open people, because when I came here, everywhere I went, when I went to college, my friends invited me home to them for Thanksgiving. People invited me to join their families for holidays. People gave me advice. I had coworkers who gave me clothes. There were so many people who were just generous and welcoming to me. And I think that that also started changing after 9/11. And it's a consequence of fear. Fear will do that to you. Fear makes us afraid of each other. And 9/11 happened, and the financial crisis happened, and so much globalization. People are losing their jobs. And obviously, there are many places you can point fingers, but you can say, well, immigrants are somewhat responsible. But I think that it is a consequence of fear and a consequence of not knowing enough about each other. But I also lived in New York City, where people are different over there. So I can't say that as an immigrant, even with all of the negative rhetoric that was going on in the past 4 years, that it really affected me. It really didn't. I felt New York City is a sort of cocoon and a very safe place for me.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. You know how in the beginning we were saying that there were a lot of things that were really right about your upbringing, and that no one was poor. Mm-hmm. In the sense that they had dignity. They had a home, they had family, they had free time, they had freedom over their time.
That's
like, right. They weren't like, you know, just jumping from one job to another to pay their bills just barely. And then that frees up your mind to think about other things other than where your next paycheck's coming from.
Right.
Why then was there still the dream of you leaving that and going to get educated in America?
That's a good point. Well, again, You there's this simplicity, right? But you can only have so much. I think that what happened is that my mother likes to say civilization. She said, oh, civilization came and it changed the way we think. I think what happened with being exposed to the bigger world is that we started thinking, oh, you could have more. You could be a doctor. You could be a lawyer. It's not enough to just be a farmer and live in a small house and go to farm and, you know, feed your kids. You can be more. So that is what it was. And I think the other big part is that Cameroon is a poor country. And while people in my town, there's a certain simplicity and laid-backness there. The struggles, if your child gets sick, you know, it's very hard to get good medical care. I mean, I can't tell you how many children died when I was a child, how many of my friends died, you know, just seeing children my age died from, you know, common illnesses or, you know, simple accidents. So every parent wants their child to have a better life than they had before. And that is the idea of America. It's not that our lives were so horrible, but we knew that there could be ways to improve on it. Yeah. But again, it's a give and take. When I go home now, I look at my cousins, I think, wow, what a wonderful life. You know, because they just have this simple life. They walk, I don't know, maybe 5-6 hours. Then they spend the rest of the day hanging out. They go from house to house, chilling. Their children run around. They don't need babysitters or nannies. Everything is so simple. And I think, oh my gosh, what a life.
Yeah, no, I know. And I guess the thing that complicates it is that with that simplicity also comes the fact that, like, you have really tough rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality. It's like we had Melinda Gates on the podcast, and I'm thinking about that conversation about global health for women, maternal health and infant health, and crossing that with this idea of simplicity versus like running around and like grinding to make your bills.
Yes. So I think that is what it is that, you know, it's a balance. Yes, you can have your simple life, but, you know, not many men can live to be 70 because, you know, it's right. Just, you know, we die very early. So I think that the reason why a lot of parents try to send their children overseas is because they want them to be able to have that simple life, but also have a chance to have it better.
Right. But it's really like a lottery ticket, because when you come, you will necessarily live through this kind of ruthless poverty as you described. And then maybe,
right,
maybe you'll find a hole in the ceiling and get through to the next level.
Right.
But maybe not. Right. I mean, maybe it's just 40 years of toil.
Maybe.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about whose stories get told. Mm-hmm. And whose stories get emphasized, and how satisfying it must feel for you to have your two books really reach like a lot of people. And that takes us to the Oprah moment. So you wrote, mm-hmm, your first novel is called Behold the Dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a chance to put a story into the minds of other people about, mm-hmm, who's driving the car that's waiting, mm-hmm, outside of Goldman Sachs to take, mm-hmm, the guy to his Hamptons, mm-hmm, house this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And to alert us to the very real fact that all of us are on these journeys at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just for fun tell us the story of Oprah picking the book and what that experience, oh, yeah, was like talking to her? And
yeah, yeah. So I mentioned earlier that I came to writing after Morrison's Song of Solomon, which I picked up at the library because it was on a bookshelf that said Oprah Book Club Pick. So I picked up an Oprah Book Club and I read it and I started writing.
And how old were you?
Yes, I was 21 then.
Uh-huh.
And I started writing. One day I saw chauffeurs and I thought to myself, what is it like to be a chauffeur? And what is the relationship between the chauffeur and the man they drive? Or at least let me explore one such relationship. And so I wrote that book and then it was published in 2016. And in 2017, I got an email from somebody at Oprah's magazine. And they said, oh, we'd like you to write a review for us. And I said, oh, cool, I will. And they said, let's make a time to talk about it, which I thought was odd because you don't need to talk about a review. You send me the book, I read it, I write the review. But they said, oh, we need to call you to talk about it. We're going to call on so-and-so day between the hours of 12 and 3. And I thought, this is all very odd. Like I wanted to say I'm busy. I don't have time.
It's like the cable guy. Like you got to stay by the front door for a 3-hour window.
I said, oh boy. And they were like, no, please. We need a little to talk about this before you do the reviews. So I said, fine. So I start by my phone, and close to 3 o'clock, the phone rings, and I picked it up, and the person said, oh, hi, Imbola, it's Oprah, and I said, oh my God. And I said, Oprah? She's like, yeah. And she started talking about how much she loved how beautiful we were. And I was like, oh my God. Like, you know, that total freak out. Like, wait, Oprah Winfrey is calling me?
Yeah. It's too much. It's too much.
And I kept on saying, oh my God. Oh my God. She goes, yeah. Oh my God, indeed.
And then did you go on the show?
Yes. Yes, I did. I went to her house. She lives in California. I flew there and I did an interview with her. She was wonderful, just really wonderful. She invited me over for drinks. So I sat on her porch and we had drinks. And people said to me, what was it like sitting with Oprah on her porch having drinks? I said, it was the most normal thing. You know, she just makes you feel so comfortable. You feel as if you're hanging out with one of your friends. I'm not good at being anything besides myself. So it certainly was easy. But she's very... she's very willing to impart on you her wisdom. She's very willing to share her advice, what she's learned, and to offer encouragement. I got to her house, I think it was about maybe 9 or 10 a.m. in the morning, and I spent the whole day there. She invited me over to have dinner also, so I had dinner with her and her staff. It was a lot of fun.
That's a long way from the village. Right? I mean, that's just crazy. Yeah,
just
everyone in your village must have been like, see, that's what happens. You go to America, you get an education, you write a book, and the next thing you're having drinks with Oprah.
When I met her, she was very forthcoming and a lot of fun to be, yeah, around. Like, she's very, just very wise. And I'm not a celebrity kind of person. I don't get caught up with celebrities. But there are people who, you look at them and look at their stories and you think, what a remarkable story. And so for me, as a person, I love to learn from people who I admire. And she's somebody that I admire for amongst many, many things, for what she does for literature. In a world where people don't read as much, she gives books so much attention.
Yeah, and they're doing something that's really important and valuable for society, which is every time you put a book in someone's hand, you're creating this world of possibility in terms of their, mm-hmm, emotional and intellectual development. So there's three ideas I want to touch on before we break up. One is bystanders and upstanders. One is like our complicity in modernity, like the idea that we're all using gas and oil every day mm-hmm. in our personal lives, even to our own massive global detriment. Mm-hmm. And then the last is the idea of monoliths, like that I thought it was really great and how beautiful we were that everybody in the village had a different opinion about mm-hmm. how to proceed at every mm-hmm. moment and mm-hmm. a different set of pressures on them that were driving their reaction to each leg of this terrible race. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about bystanders and upstanders and what you're trying to get at there?
That is certainly something that I think about a lot, about why people choose to fight and why they choose to not. And it's very hard to figure out because I think about myself. People say to me, oh, you wrote a book about people who stand up and about you have a fascination with revolutionaries, right? So you must be an activist, right? But I've never been part of any movement, right? I've marched in protests. I lived in Midtown Manhattan, so you know, there's a protest and I just joined right in. I was one of those people in college who, you know, got around and, you know, led the movement to change this or try to change this system. So I am more in the middle. So I can appreciate people who choose to and people who choose not to. And that it's just a very personal decision. And I don't judge anybody for going one way or another, because there's a lot of risk involved in either way, right? There's a risk involved in taking a stand. It's a risk involved in not doing anything.
A stand could get you injured, jailed, killed.
That's right. That's right. And that is something which I looked at when I was thinking about the character of Tula, who grows up to become a revolutionary. And I thought about, you know, the Dr. King, who was killed at 39. He didn't get to see his children get married. Or Malcolm X killed at 39. Or Mandela in prison for 27 years. So there's a lot. There's a toll that you have to put on your family also. I remember a fellow writer, he was put in jail recently for his writing. And when he came out, I said to him, I said, like, how was it for you? He said, I could have stayed in that jail forever, but I had to get out because of my family. Because, wow. They just could not handle what I had to do. Like, I needed to take a stand, but they needed me to get out because they didn't sign up for this.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting if you think about the monolith question, right? Which is that when we simplify stories, then it says all the villagers rose up and all the people at the corporation were horrible. And it's like, and that's what a novel can do that almost nothing else can, because it has time to say, not really all the villagers. Yeah. Like some villagers were bowing to the pressures of their family and thinking, my wife is not strong enough for me to risk everything. I have to be in that house every night or those kids are going to go hungry. Right. And then other villagers have the option to participate at a different level because of whatever their personal circumstances are. So I think it's really powerful to like dismantle monoliths where we see them.
That's right. And even the ones who choose to join in, they have different motivations, right? Some people, you know, want fame and glory. Some people want money. Some people want, you know, to have fun. People have their motivations. And that is the wonderful thing about literature, like you said, that it allows you to, instead of saying, these people fighting together. And because when you think about civil rights movements and anti-apartheid movement, it's always a group of people. But these movements are made of individuals. And so it was important to me that I don't put everybody in one bucket, that I look at the main players and examine their motivations, just the same way I do with the corporation, which I don't spend as much time with them, but I still have to look at the corporation, the people who work there, because when we talk about corporation, we talk about, oh, greedy corporation. Well, greedy corporations are made of humans, and there's some humans there who are greedy, which is how it ends up being a greedy corporation. But the humans there who are also not greedy, who are trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the business of judging people. That as a writer, my business is not to judge. My business is to say, let me just tell your story and let the reader decide what they think of you.
Yeah, I think that every time people dig into like what is perceived to be in like big broad terms evil and flesh out each of those people, I just do think it's a service in restoring humanity to the picture.
I agree.
Now, my last question is about how to live in the world without damaging the world. Mm. You know, How Beautiful We Were is, I mean, the title itself is kind of pointing us toward a lot in this conversation. You know, like, what is it like to live simply and small without dependence on the things that are going to inevitably challenge life on Earth?
Mm.
So what did you mean by How Beautiful We Were?
Well, I think that tattoo is some sort of, it has a lot to do with the past and about choices that were made that affected numerous people in the present and in the future. You know, I think a lot about the kind of world I'm going to leave behind as far as for the next generation, because it's not enough to make choices that work for you right now. As a person, as a writer, I haven't benefited from choices that other people made in the past. And so writing this book was coming to terms with the fact that I have to be responsible for the future generation. I am very aware of how complicit I am in a lot of what is happening in the world now and what might happen in the future. I think the issue of what is my role in all this, I think that something that weighed on my mind a lot, like how much my decisions matter. And so How Beautiful We Were, I think that idea is nostalgia, right? For a time when people really came together for a common good, as opposed to being stuck on their own individual ambitions.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me, Imbolo. So fun to be with you again.
Thank you so much.
I loved talking to Imbolo. I find her to be charming and thoughtful and direct. I want to share with you my takeaways. Number one, when all you know about America is from television, you are in for quite a shock. Two, it is possible to transition from lingerie salesperson to decorated novelist. Three, finding your calling, loving your job, satisfying your soul, these are distinctly American ideas. Four, when you grow up in a place where you can't really say a bad word about the guy who's been running the show for 40 years, free speech and democracy feel like miracles. Number five, books are sacred. So are libraries. Number six, American poverty is ruthless, draining, and dehumanizing. Number seven, fear is at the bottom of a lot of our division. And number eight, if you want to know someone's essence, ask them to tell you about who their people are and where they came from. I want to thank writer Imbolo Mbue. I also want to thank my team at Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's Dean Kateri and Susan George. And most of all, I want to thank you guys. Thank you for sharing episodes. Thank you for starting podcast listening clubs. And thanks for meeting me on Instagram at Kelly Corrigan to talk about each episode.